Okay, so today it's neat because you're going to learn to know as much about the wave function of a real one electron atom as anybody knows, right, at the end of today. Okay. So we saw last time that quantum mechanics might be worth studying because it tells you about everything. And we saw last time allowed energies and structures. And just to review what we did at the end last time about dynamics and bonding, we saw that if we guessed that this was a trial solutions for a Hooke's law potential, we knew that one was too low and one was too high in energy and that the correct one would lie between. So that's, that purple one is for a single well. But in fact, if you have two wells next to one another, then those red and blue ones are the correct values, one lower and one higher than it would be if you had only a single well. So the correct single minimum lies between these two energies. And if the wells were further apart rather than 0.6, if they were 1.3 apart, then you see that the true functions for this double well potential are in fact the same as they are for a single well. Right? Looks just like the single well. Same curvature, same kinetic energy. So if they're far apart, these two wells, then they behave just like single wells in energy and shape. But if they get close together, then you get different energies. One corresponding to having a lower energy with less curvature, the blue one, and one corresponding to have higher energy than it would have had if there were just a single or two widely separated ones. So this splitting that results from two wells being near one another allows a lower energy. It also allows a higher energy. But if you had your choice and you were a particle, you'd choose the lower energy more likely than not. So it's possible. So you can lower your energy by having two wells come together. If the two wells are far apart, you have a certain energy. And the wave function can be made by adding the two individual wave functions. But if they're close together and you add them, then you get lower curvature and lower energy because the kinetic energy is lower. Right? And that results in stabilization of the particle. So the particle is lower in energy when they're together than when they're apart. That means they like to be together. That constitutes a bond. Right? By the same token, it's also possible to have the difference of the two wave functions in the two wells, right? One minus the other. Then you have more curvature than you had before. This is antibonding, right? You could have either one, but you'd probably prefer to be bonding than to be antibonding. It's lower in energy. Okay, now, so in this case, kinetic energy is clearly what causes the bonding, the lowering of kinetic energy when the wells are close together. We'll talk about bonding of atoms in lecture 12 after we understand atoms themselves. And you'll see that it's a little more complicated in that case, but still fundamentally the same thing. When the two wells are closer together, the energy is lower, and that's bonding. Potential energy also enters in when you have Coulombic potentials rather than what we're using here, the simpler Hooke's law. But still, fundamentally, it's this lowering of kinetic energy that allows you to do this trick. That's what bonds are. Okay, but more than bonds, you can also, in these double well things, understand a phenomenon called tunneling, which is dynamic. So suppose you had a particle and you stopped it there, so it's got, this is the total energy it's got is how much, and then you let it go. What's it going to do? Well, it'll roll back and forth, obviously. Okay, so it'll go back and forth. And it would just, if no friction and so on, it would just keep doing that. But the special thing about quantum mechanics is that even though there's that barrier on the right, that is in the middle, it's possible to go through the barrier. That's what that digs a tunnel. Well, at least that's what people say. And then it can go back and forth on the other side, or it could tunnel back to the first one. So it can get from one well to the other without having enough energy to go over this barrier that's in between them. A ball would never do that, right? Now, I use the word tunneling, and I'll use it a lot, but really it's not a good word. It's misleading, it's mischievous, because it suggests there's something weird about the potential energy when you have a double minimum like that somehow you can bore through that barrier. That's not true at all, right? You don't go through the barrier. It's not a tunnel that you do. It simply involves having negative kinetic energy that you see in every wave function, which has a boundary on each side. You know that you have the energy has to be quantized. You've worked these. If it's open on one side, either because there is no barrier there or because you have an energy that's higher than how high it gets to on one side, then you can get sine waves out there and you can have any old energy you want, right? But if there's a barrier on both sides that you don't have enough energy for, then the wave function has to hunker down on both sides and you have to have precisely the right energy. It's quantized. Okay, so every bounded wave function that has these barriers on each side has probability in regions of negative kinetic energy. So almost everything has that. Only particles that are free don't have that property of having some of their lifetime negative kinetic energy. And that's what's involved in getting from one well to the other here. It's not that you bore through the potential energy thing with a tunnel. What happens is, as it starts to roll, it's possible to get negative kinetic energy, and then you can go over the barrier, and now on this side you can get back to positive kinetic energy again, right? And then negative kinetic energy, as always, when you're out on the far left or right in such a situation. So this wave function, you'll notice in these regions, is curving away from the baseline. That's negative kinetic energy. On the edge, we've seen that many times, but also in the middle with this double minimum potential when you don't have enough total energy to get over the top of the potential energy barrier. Okay? Are there any questions about this, or does this seem normal once you've swallowed the idea you can have negative kinetic energy? Yeah.
What does that physically mean?
Negative kinetic energy? It means that the total energy, which is something that's physical, and the potential energy, which is something physical, that the potential energy is higher than the total energy. If the difference is kinetic energy, then the kinetic energy is negative. Now, we're very intuitively tied up with the idea that kinetic energy is 1/2 mv squared, right? But if you make the quantum leap that to the idea that kinetic energy is not 1/2 mv squared, it's the curvature of the wave function divided by the value of the wave function and the mass, times a constant, negative constant, then there's nothing special here. Yeah, Nate?
What happens when an object with negative kinetic energy collides with another object?
Now, when something collides, you're talking about something happening in time, right? So that's time dependent, and we're not talking about time dependence now, although indeed we are going to be talking about time dependence right now. This tunneling, when you're in one well, and then you can be in the other well, there's the interesting question, how long does it take to get from one well to the other? How long does it take to get over this barrier where you have to have negative kinetic energy? And that obviously is a question of time dependence to answer a question like that, and we're going to deal with it right now because the time it takes to get from one well to the other is 5 × 10⁻¹⁴ seconds divided by this splitting. The difference between these two, remember one of them is the sum of the two wave functions with no nodes in each well. The other one is the difference of the two, right? And the difference in energy between those two is the splitting. And if you divide that splitting into 5 × 10⁻¹⁴ seconds, you get how long it takes to get from one to the other. Right? Now, that seems mysterious to you because I'm just asserting it. I'm not proving it. It depends on, it's a question of time, so it depends on, it's time-dependent quantum mechanics. And it doesn't take too long to talk about that, but I'm not going to do it now. Okay? But I think it's interesting to see what this, how you apply that. So if you know that energy difference is 1.4 kilocalories per mole, then it turns out that it's about 4 × 10⁻¹⁴ seconds to get from one well to the other well. Now, suppose those two wells were further apart. What changes? We just talked about that. The splitting gets smaller, right? So what happens to how long it takes to get from one to the other? It gets longer, right? Because it's in the denominator, the splitting. So if you make the splitting smaller, and that makes sense, that the further apart those two things are, the longer you have to go with negative kinetic energy, the slower it's going to be. Right? And that turns out to be true. Okay, so that's something about dynamics and bonding. But now let's look about reactivity, except we'll look at it later on. Okay? But anyhow, this simple program, this Erwin meets Goldilocks thing, can find size for any complicated potential energy. You can draw in a potential energy, although the algorithm that's used to do it isn't very convenient, but you can draw in anything and get what its wave function looks like. You can do a Morse potential, for example. You can rank the various energies by the various wave functions by their curvature, by the number of nodes, by their energy. You can see when a wave function is not going to be a solution. There's one that looks more or less okay, but it's not a solution. How can you just glance at that and tell that that's not going to be a solution? Yeah. What's wrong on the left? Let's do the right side first. Pardon me. Because that's the way I've got the slide set up. Aisha? Right. The right side is crossing zero in a region of negative kinetic energy. If you do that, when you're in a region of negative kinetic energy, you're going to keep curving away from the baseline. Right? So it's bound to go to infinity. You can't have something like that in the gray region. It's not satisfactory because it's got to go like that. The only way to survive in that negative kinetic energy region that goes on forever is to get down to the baseline asymptotically quickly. Okay? And now on the left, Wojtek? Right, it looks like it's settling down, but it's not settling down at zero. Right? So in fact, that will go up that way, and that's so you can't slope, you can't be going out in such a region and away from the baseline. Because if you're going away from the baseline and curving away from the baseline, you're going to go to infinity. So you got to be approaching the baseline when you're out there. You can't be sloping away from it. Okay, so we're in pretty good shape. That we can see immediately that that's not going to work. We can even handle these multiple minima and understand tunneling and bonding. So we're riding high here. Unfortunately, this approach, remember how the approach works as Erwin meets Goldilocks. We have a bunch of things we know, and those allow us to tell what the curvature of the wave function is going to be. We can calculate, we can get what the kinetic energy is from the difference between our guessed total and the potential, which is given to us. Then we know the curvature, so we can trace this thing out. But it won't work if you have more dimensions, because you don't know, when you have more dimensions, you have curvatures in other directions as well, not just along one dimension. So you don't know how much of that curvature to put in curving this way, and how much to put in curving this way, and how much to curve along the Z, right? So you can't do that trick if you have more than one dimension. So when there are many curvatures, it's not clear how to partition the kinetic energy among the different curvature contributions. So we're in bad trouble. But Schrödinger, in fact, had no trouble in finding solutions for the three-dimensional hydrogen atom because they were familiar from a long tradition of physicists and mathematicians studying waves. They knew how to solve this kind of problem. So when he formulated the problem having to do with curvature, that's a second-order differential equation, people had solved it for more than 100 years. So a frustration for you people is that you don't know, most of you, differential equations yet, and second-order differential equations in many dimensions. So you can't see how you would do this. But what I'm trying to point out is that Schrödinger didn't figure out how to do it. He had just studied things that told him how to do it. So when he knew those, when he saw what the equations were, he said, aha, this is the solution, and just wrote it down. So you can do the same thing that he did. There are tables that allow you to write these. Right, so you can use the same table Schrödinger used. So you don't feel inferior to Schrödinger. Okay? And the way they started, we've done one dimension. Two dimensions was a halfway house between one dimension and three dimensions. So let's look just a second, historically, at Chladni figures in two dimensions. So this is Ernst Florence Friedrich Chladni, who was in lived in Prussia and Eastern Germany and part of Poland now. And this is the book he wrote, Acoustics, prepared by Ernst Florence Friedrich Chladni. This is from the Yale Library, and this version is from 1830. But in fact, you see it's the, someplace here it says a new unchanged edition. This is in fact, I think, the third edition. Right, there's the title page. And what he did, he was interested, as it says, in acoustics. So he was interested in how things vibrated, bells, drums, violins, violin, the body of a violin, the string of a violin, and so on. And one thing he did was take a plate of glass or metal, suspend it in the middle, touch it someplace, put sand on it, and bow it with a violin bow. So he would touch in different places, and he'd bow in different places, and he'd get the sand would collect where the plate was not vibrating. Okay? Wherever it was vibrating, it gets shaken away. So he could see what the pattern was of the vibration of these things and tried to relate it to pitch. So let's try doing an experiment like that. The experiment, actually, that he did was first done 100 years earlier by Robert Hooke, who we've talked about a number of times. Okay, now let's see here. You have to keep the sand off the projector. So here's a metal plate, the brass plate, which I dried out on Sunday, but it might not be dry enough to work well now. You know, I can't play the violin. Some of you play the violin, I'm sure. Maybe you could do this. You know what happens when I play the violin? What do you think it sounds like? Squawk, right? And the reason is, it's not vibrating in a clean pattern. There are many different vibrations going on at the same time. You people who know how to play the violin know just how to do it. So you get one clean vibration or a clean family of vibrations. So I also don't know very well how to play the brass plate, as it turns out. But we're going to see if we can get something here that will give you the idea of it. Now, I don't have a violin bow. So the way I'm going to make it vibrate is somewhat different. Put this down. See, I got sand here. I'll wait till the last minute to put the sand on so it doesn't get wet. And I'll show you the idea. Okay, so here's a brass plate. And what I'm going to use instead of a bow is a piece of dry ice. Right? So I'm going to touch it with a piece of dry ice. When I do that, the dry ice will sublime and there'll be a little pressure pulse and it'll bend the plate and push it away. Not that much, of course, just a little bit. But when it goes away, then it's not touching the dry ice anymore. So there's no more pulse. So now the plate goes back, so the plate will vibrate when it touches the dry ice. Got the idea? So that's what I'm going to do here. Here's some dry ice. And I'll try to cut it so it's a little bit sharp. Yeah, that might work. So here we'll put a little sand on here. And of course it's important that the dry ice touch the plate, make thermal contact with it. It won't work otherwise, so I have to clear a little point here someplace where I can touch it. And I'll pick up a piece of the dry ice. And I'll touch the plate someplace and see what happens. See, when I get a clean tone, it forms a pattern. That's where the plate was not vibrating. You could try this afterwards if you want to. It's fun. Maybe some of you will be good at playing it. Okay. But instead, I'll show you a time I lucked out. Okay. As Fortunately, I filmed it this time. Isn't that neat? So you can go and see that in a couple other times. This is the best one that I did. Okay, so here are some Chladni figures that I made. One of them was three circles. Another one was this, which I think is the same. It's the same as that one, although it's developed a little more. Another one was this, which has three diameters and one circle. That one has two circles and one diameter, right? This one has four diameters and one circle. It's fun to do this. Because if you were good at playing this, you'd know just how to do it for the different ones. I don't. I just fiddle around. Yeah.
What affects the shape? Where you hold it on the side?
Well, where you touch it, it tends not to move. Right, so there might be a node where there's a node where you touch it, and then where you touch it with the dry ice is where it moves a lot. So that's sort of the center of one of these, ideally. But I can tell you that it doesn't work that simply, and generally you get squawks because you do many different vibrations at the same time. Okay, so here are Chladni's figures from that book. There's one with two diameters. One with three diameters, one with four diameters, five diameters. And then here are ones that have circles as well as diameters, like the one there that did, which had two circles and a diameter. Okay. Think, for example, just about the one at the bottom here. Another way of drawing it with colors would be to show where the plate is bending up in blue and where it's bending down in yellow. Right, and then it's not bending at all along those lines, right? And here's a picture I took from the web, an animation showing the red lines show where the red dots and line show where it's not bending, and then you can see the plate vibrating. See how it's flat. Now it goes the other way. So that's this particular mode of vibration, which has a particular frequency. You heard when it did this that there was one clear tone. So what Chladni, who was interested in acoustics, was interested in is how does the nodal pattern relate to the pitch you get? Okay, and he did violins and things too, as I said, put sand on violins and so on. Okay, so here's what he discovered with his circular plate. He also did square plates, oval plates, all kinds of things. Okay, so how many diametrical nodes are there, these lines, and how many circular nodes are there? And then for each of these 47 patterns, there was a question of what the pitch would be. So that pitch was a C, for example. Right? Now, he said these pitch relationships agree approximately with squares of the following numbers. So he was just trying to see what relationship he could get. This wasn't dependent on fundamental theory. So, for example, he said that his proposal here is the frequency is about equal to the number of diameter nodes plus 2 times the number of circular nodes, the whole number squared. So, for example, you could have one circle. So the number the frequency would be proportional to 4, right? 2 times the number of circular nodes is 1, 2 squared is 4. Or you could have two lines, right? Square that, you get 4. So those two gave the same pitch. Okay? Or notice that if you increase there are an increasing number of ways to get a higher frequencies by mixing different numbers of circles and lines. So, for example, to get the number 8, you can have 4 circles, 3 circles, and 2 lines, 2 circles, 4 lines, 1 circle, 6 lines, or 8 lines. All those will give the same pitch, approximately. Okay? And those little numbers, the minuses or the pluses, means a little sharp or a little flat. Yeah? Pardon me? It's just proportional to that. He probably measured. I don't know what he measured it in. I'd have to look again. But it's, there's some constant you multiply this number by, and then you get the frequency. Okay, you could easily tell twice the frequency because it's an octave up, right? So if you get something that's twice as big, it's an octave above the one you just heard. Okay, now, Chladni wasn't a mathematician, but a lot of contemporary mathematicians worked on these problems, both the vibration of a plane, but also the three-dimensional vibration of a solid body rather than just something that's two-dimensional. So these people included Bernoulli, Euler, two different money and a postage stamp for Euler, although you can't use the stamp anymore because it's East Germany. Lagrange, Laplace. In fact, we've already dealt with Laplace, although we didn't mention his name, because the second derivative with respect to x plus y plus z, which is abbreviated del, upside down delta squared, that's called the Laplacian operator because he's the guy that started doing that. And that, remember, is what the kinetic energy is this Laplacian of the function. Okay, so size for one electron atoms involve Laplace's things called spherical harmonics, which are 3D analogs of these two-dimensional figures we've just looking at. So if something's vibrating, but there are certain places it's not vibrating and it has more vibration some places than others, right? And this is how you write them, the three-dimensional wave functions for a hydrogen atom, which Schrödinger knew he could just look them up in a table the way you're going to do, because they'd already been done for these acoustics problems. Okay, so the wave function psi, a function of rho, theta, and phi, is a product of these three functions. Now that looks sort of mysterious to you, I'm guessing. And of course, it had contributions from other old-time mathematicians too, like Edmond Laguerre, who had this thing called the associated Laguerre polynomial, which is what the R function is, or Adrien-Marie Legendre, who did the theta function, which is called an associated Legendre function. But we're not a math class, so we're not interested in all these names. All we want to do is use the table and see what the functions look like. And there they are, easy as pie. Okay, so how do we deal with this thing? Well, we have a coordinate system, a particle, an electron, going around a nucleus, n, right? And the electron has x, y, and z coordinates. If we were being really, really picky, you'd say that the nucleus doesn't have infinite mass compared to the electron. So in fact, the nucleus moves just a little bit while the electron moves, preserving the center of mass. But it's not a bad approximation to say that the nucleus is at the origin, right? But it brings in no further fundamental complications to keep the center of mass fixed. We'll pretend the nucleus is at the origin. Okay, so we need to know psi, the wave function, the number assigned to every position that the electron can have in three-dimensional space. That's the psi function. Okay? Now, the potential energy will vary as you vary the position of the electron. That's what you're given, the mass of the electron and its potential energy as a function of position. But we know the potential energy, it's Coulomb's law. It's 1 over the distance. But the distance in Cartesian space is a rather complicated function, right? The distance is the square root of x squared plus y squared plus z squared. So the potential energy is 1 over that times some constant. Okay? But that's, you can see that functions are going to be hard to deal with if we have something that complicated. So the psi written in XYZ is very complicated. But there's a clever trick you can do, which is you change the coordinate system, and instead of XYZ, you use the distance between the two particles and those two angles, theta, the blue one, and phi, the green one. Right? And what's the advantage of using this coordinate system? Can you guess what the advantage might be? Why are things simpler if you use this one? Yeah, Connor? Which one dimension? What do you mean? Yeah, the potential energy will depend only on R, not on theta and not on phi. Now, we're not doing math, and I couldn't do it anyhow without brushing up a lot. But that simplifies the potential energy much greatly. Now it's only a constant divided by r. And that means that the mathematically the thing is much easier to solve, and that in fact you can write the solution in r, theta, and phi instead of x, y, z as just a product of three really simple functions. So instead of having something that's just a mess in x, y, and z, you have something that's some r function, a simple function, some theta function, and some phi function. You multiply them together and you get the function of three dimensions. That's a very easy way to get a function of three dimensions. So the three columns of this table are the red r function, the blue theta function, and the green phi function. Right? So you take one from this column, times one in this column, times one in this column, and that gives you psi, a function of three dimensions. Okay? Now, you can't just choose anything you want. You have to, those various possibilities in the different rows have names. The names are given by quantum numbers, N, L, M. Okay? So you have to choose. Or, I've also given them here in red in their familiar names. Like N is 1, L is 0 up at the top right. That's the 1s orbital, right? Or if N is 2 and L is 0, that's 2s. Okay? And now, if N is 2 and L is 1, the third one down here, that's 2p. But there are three different 2p orbitals. So now you have to choose the theta and phi functions that correspond. So you'd choose, if you were talking about pz, you choose 2p here, pz, the second one down here, and the one at the top there for the phi function that works both for s and for z, and also incidentally for z squared, if you have a z squared name in your orbital. Okay, now you name them by these numbers, and N has to be bigger than L, and L has to be greater than or equal to M. Or you can use a nickname like 1S or 2PZ and so on. Okay? So you don't know how to get these, but Schrödinger didn't know how to get these in the sense that he didn't figure it out, right? They were in tables, and he could look them up, and that's what we're doing. But let's look at, but these are the real McCoy. These are what hydrogen atom wave functions actually are. These solve Schrödinger's equation. So nobody knows any more about them than you do, or at least than you can figure out by looking at them, because that's the real thing. So you know, people, when they write textbooks, draw these fuzzy pictures and all kinds of things, right? But this is what's real. So somehow those pictures that they draw represent this. So one of the problems I want you to work on is to figure out how you can draw pictures of these complicated functions that look like things you've seen before for these atomic wave functions. Okay, so let's look at it a little bit. First, notice that that R function looks complicated. Part of the reason it looks complicated is that every one of them has something in it that's z over a zero to the 3/2 power. Now, if you're going to get probability density, how do you get probability density from the wave function? You square it. So when you square that constant, you're going to get z over a zero cubed. So z is a number. It's the atomic number, or the charge of the nucleus. And a zero is a unit of length. It's called the Bohr radius, right? So what you have is z over a distance cubed, z per volume. So this is the units you have for probability density. How much per volume, right? Okay, so they all have that in it. That's no surprise. Okay, now let's just do the 1s orbital. So what are we going to choose? What r function are we going to choose? Cassie? Top one. Okay, so we're going to that constant z over a zero to the 3/2 times 2 times e to the minus rho over 2, whatever rho is. Okay? And then how about the theta function? Who's going to help me with that? Which theta function shall we choose if we're doing 1s? Pardon me? Can't hear. Can't even see who's saying. Well, right, the top one, because it's 0, 0. L has to be greater than, smaller than n, right? So S, square root of 2 over 2. And how about the phi function? right? The top again, 1 over square root of 2 pi. And so let's write it out. It's those three. Multiply them together. So notice what it is a bunch of constants, square root of 2 and pi and things like that, okay, times e to the minus rho over 2. That's the variable part. Everything else is just a constant. So just group all the constants together and see what kind of shape the thing has. So it's e to the minus rho over 2. And if we're going to square it to get probability, then it's going to be k squared times e to the minus rho. So e to the minus rho is what's controlling the probability density, right? There it is. And if we do this, let's just see what that constant is. There are all the numbers. We cancel the 2's, cancel the square root of 2's. And then if we square it, we get 1 over pi times, in the denominator, 0.53 angstroms, that's A0, cubed. That corresponds to be 2.14 over A0 cubed. That's the electron density at the hydrogen nucleus, because rho measures the distance. Right? So if the distance is 0, e to the 0 is 1. So the value of the wave function at the nucleus is 2.14 per cubic angstrom. That's the value. Did I say the value of the wave function? That's the value of the square of the wave function. That's the probability density of the electron at the nucleus, is 2 per cubic angstrom. That's greater than 1. How can the probability be greater than 1? How can a probability be greater than 1? Nathan? Can't hear very well.
The math is wrong?
No, the math is right. But I said something that's wrong. I said the probability is greater than 1. Is that true? It's the probability density is greater than 1. It's not that great over a whole cubic angstrom. Right? It's 2.14 per cubic angstrom, but it only is that high over a very small volume. So you have a high probability density, but not a very high probability, or not that high a probability, not greater than 1. Okay, now, incidentally, how much less dense at the nucleus would it be if you had a 2s orbital rather than a 1s orbital? What would be the difference if you had a 2s orbital? So now you go down to 2s, but you use the same things for the other parts. So the only difference is you have you have 2 minus rho. See that? At the nucleus, what's rho? 0. So forget that. It's 2, same as it was above. The only thing you have is 2 times the square root of 2 in the denominator. That's the only difference. Everybody see that? Okay, so we're going to square that to get the probability density. It's going to be 4 times 2 instead of 2 times the square root of 2. That's 4 times 2 is 8. So it's going to be 8 times less dense at the nucleus in a 2s than in a 1s orbital. I bet you didn't know that. Right? But it's easy to see. So I want you to do things like this, to use these tables and figure things out. Now, why do you use rho instead of r? We had r over there. There's a neat reason to do that. Rho is, in fact, just some constant times r. But the constant changes if you change the nuclear charge z, or if you change which quantum level you're in, n. But the neat thing about it is that you can use, if you use rho instead of r, then all these equations apply to everything, right? Any one electron atom. Right? It allows writing the same e to the minus rho over 2 for any nuclear charge and any n. And you'll notice that that's in every one of these functions is e to the minus rho over 2. Right? If you measured it in r, it would vary for all the different nuclear charges and so on. But how would you expect the probability density to change if you increase the nuclear charge? What do you expect? Increase the nuclear charge. Here's the wave function. It looks something like this. How's it going to look if you may have a higher nuclear charge? It's going to be pulled in, right? But here, if you use, you don't care what z is, you can use, that is, you can use this same rho over e to the minus rho over 2 for any z, as long as you scale, as long as you write it in rho, which is z times r. That means if you made z twice as big, the scale changes by a factor of 2, right? So if you had a charge of 2 in the nucleus, helium, it would contract by a factor of 2. But you use the same equation. So that's really handy. So everyone has that. So it's an all-purpose curve, but it gets shrunk as z increases. And it gets expanded if you go to a higher wave function, higher n value. So here's the probability e to the minus rho, that, or that part of it. You'd multiply by a constant, of course. And so for 1H, for the 1s of an H atom, R for H is 0.53 angstroms over 2 times rho for the 1s, okay? Or 0.26 times rho. So here it is, whited out for in units of rho. Here it is in real units of angstroms, right? Okay. And it turns out that at r equals 0, or rho equals 0, the density is about 2 electrons per cubic angstrom. That's what we just, 2.16. We just looked at that on the last slide. Okay. Now, if it were a carbon instead of hydrogen, then you have a bigger nuclear charge, so the denominator has 12 in it rather than 2. And so now, that would be the scale in angstroms. Or if we wanted to have an angstrom scale uniformly, we'd have to suck that carbon one toward the nucleus, right? 6 times, right? It would look like that, much closer to the nucleus for the carbon for the 1s, right? Now, of course, if it's going to be probability density, so that when you integrate it everywhere it gets to 1, if it's much closer, it has to be much higher too, much higher density to get the same total amount in there. So you have to renormalize it, multiplying it by 216, the cube of 6. So actually, it would look like that, right? So the H doesn't fall off very fast. It keeps going, but it starts very low. Carbon starts very high at the nucleus, but falls away very fast for the 1s orbital. Okay, it's 216 times higher than hydrogen at the nucleus. But this is not what you'd see in X-ray, because although the wave function looks like that, the atom in an X-ray picture is vibrating. So it gets averaged out. It can't be that sharp. It gets blurred. So it wouldn't look that much more dense. Okay, now what would the exponential part of a 2s orbital look like? Right? So you can think about that one. And here are some problems for Wednesday. First, about these two-dimensional things. Why don't you see Chladni figures with an odd number of radial nodes? We saw only diameters, right? Not radii. You couldn't get 3 or 5, however you do that. Okay? Why not? Okay, why are the first two cells in Chladni's table vacant for 0, 0, and 1, 0? Compare 1s with 2s in energy, and do the 6 atomic orbital problems. You can click there to see it, or it's on the web page. Now, the shape of psi, right? There are all these constants in there, but more interesting is what the shape looks like, independent of the thing. So the 1s orbital is a constant times e to the minus rho over 2. You could hardly have a simpler function, right? And this is much, much simpler than it was in one dimension. Remember when we tried to do Erwin meets Goldilocks in one dimension, you got these funny things that had a big deal in the middle, right? This is nothing like that. It's just a decreasing exponential as you move out in any direction from the nucleus. It couldn't be simpler. Okay, 2s. Now we look at that's those three things multiplied together. And now in looking at the shape, we look at what varies, not what the constants are, but what's varying as you change things. So the theta and the phi functions are just constants, forget that. What's varying in a 2s orbital? In a 1s, all that was varying was rho and this exponential decay. Okay? What varies, which parts vary, for a 2s? Natalie? What varies? So 2s is this. Does that vary? Natalie? No. This. Does that vary? And this. Now, does this part here vary? No. It has the nuclear charge, but for any given problem, it doesn't vary with position. Okay. Does this vary with position? 2 minus rho. Yeah, absolutely, that varies. And does this vary with position, e to the minus rho? Yeah, okay, so these are the parts that are varying. It's just some constant times those two. So it's some constant times 2 minus rho times e to the minus rho over 2. Okay, now, so e to the minus rho over 2, we know what that does. That's just going away. What does 2 minus rho look like? What is it when rho is 0? So at the nucleus, that's contributing 2. Okay. Now, as you go out, what happens? As rho increases, it decreases from 2. When is it particularly interesting? At what value of rho? At rho equals 2, it goes through 0. And beyond that? Now it's negative. Right? So it keeps getting more and more negative, 2 minus rho. But e to the minus rho keeps making things smaller and smaller. So when you multiply those things together, you start at 2, you start going down, you go through 0 at rho equals 2, then you keep going down, but then e to the minus rho makes it smaller and smaller, and it'll come back up again. See? So you did it. Okay. So there's a spherical node. At rho equals 2, in any direction, the value of the wave function is 0. It's changing from positive to negative. That's a node. So a 2s orbital has a spherical node. Okay, now how about a 2pz? This is going to be fun. Okay, so there's the 2p, pz, and z. So what's varying? John, what do you say? What varies in 2pz? Does this vary? That? Okay, so cosine of theta. Here's the theta angle. It's going to have the cosine of theta in it. That's going to vary. How about this? Does this part vary? No. But it's got rho times e to the minus rho. Okay? So it's rho times the cosine of theta times e to the minus rho times some constant, which is all those other things. Now, that's a little complicated, right? But let's try to understand rho times the cosine of theta. Rho, remember, is the same as r multiplied by a constant. Okay? So actually, it's r cosine theta. What's r cosine theta? Anybody see what r cosine theta is? Nathan? Z. Right? Okay, so we could replace it. Z. We're sort of mixing our coordinate systems. We got Z and we got rho. This is spherical polar coordinates and this is Cartesian coordinates, but this makes it much easier to see what's going on. So it's Z times e to the minus rho over 2. Is there a node of this one? Is there some place or region where the value is 0? When Z equals 0, a positive Z, this has a positive value. Negative Z, it has negative value. On the Z equals 0 plane, it has a node. You know that's what the P orbital, PZ orbital looks like, right? It has a node, positive up, negative down. Okay, now, so it's got a planar node at Z equals 2, and now here's a question for you. Guess what 2PX and 2PY look like? Now, you could do it here. You could say 2PX X or 2PYY. And now you're going to have sines or cosines and sine and rho, and it's going to be really complicated. That's not what I want you to do. I want you to guess what it looks like. Yeah. Right. You just, for the 2PX, you put X there. For 2PY, you put Y there. Pretty straightforward, right? Okay. Now, let's look at the angular, how it varies with theta. So this, we're going to make a plot of cosine theta versus theta. So at theta equals 0, going out to the right, The cosine is 1. Okay, there it is. Okay, at 30 degrees, it's 1 over the square root of 2 over the square root of 3, or whatever it is. 1 over the square root of 3. Okay, so it's 0.86 anyhow. At 45 degrees, it's 1 over square root of 2. And at 60 degrees, it's 0.5. And at 90 degrees, it's 0. So can you see what it looks like? Right? And how about if you went higher than 90 degrees? What's the cosine when you have greater than 90 degrees? It's negative, but it's going to be the same thing. So there's a p orbital, right? Or if you square it, if you do cosine squared, then it looks like that. And you've seen pictures like that of a p orbital. What they're plotting is how it varies with theta, forgetting how it varies with r, right? Or if you take this one, we're just about done here. This is a contour plot of a 2p orbital, right? It's most dense there and less dense. This is x and y. So it's the 2py orbital, right? Sliced through the nucleus. But let's use these coordinates, polar coordinates. Okay, so there's rho, how far out from the origin? And here's theta, how far down? How about phi? How does it vary if we got out of this plane and changed phi? How does it vary with phi? It doesn't. So we could take this picture and just rotate it like this in any dimension we want to, and it's going to be, you see what it looks like, an hourglass sort of. Okay, now let's try to find out. So phi doesn't make any difference. It's axially symmetric. Okay, now let's try to find out from this, where is the maximum value? What value of theta is this going to have a maximum at? 0, right? It's going to be 1. Okay, so it's going to be along the axis. Right? How far out? Well, we could take the derivative of the rest of this with respect to rho and set it equal to 0 at the maximum. Right? So if you do that, you get this and solve it, and it's at rho equals 2. There. Right? And you can figure out with the constants what that maximum is for a 2p orbital of a carbon plus 6. Okay? So this is the kind of things you can do with that table. It's fun to figure out what these things that people have been telling you about in fuzzy terms really look like, because those are the real functions. Okay, now we're going to have the exam, as you know, on Friday. It'll be in two sessions in this room and the other room, and I'll give this review session on Wednesday night. Thanks.
So this lecture is...
This lecture is on it, but this is the end. Everything that's on Wednesday will be on the next exam. Okay, so this gives you a little time for this to sink in. If anybody wants to try to play the plate, feel free.